Hi, everybody. I'm Gene Simmons, and you're not. And you are listening to the number one KISS podcast, Shout It Out Loudcast, with Tom and Zeus. But you knew that. Now get out of here.
That's right, a special 50th episode of Dorm Damage, and what a way to celebrate. We have rock and roll royalty in the house tonight, Zeus. Who is joining us for episode 50?
Legendary bassist Rudy Sarzo.
Oh my God, incredible.
Yes, and Rudy, for those who know, and if you're one of those who don't know, which is a shock, part of Quiet Riot, played in Ozzy's band with Randy Rhoads, Whitesnake, been part of Jeff Tate's Queensryche, he's been part of Dio, he's played with the Guess Who band, he's done a million things. He's got podcasts, he's got a radio shows. He is, honestly, and it's funny because I told him this, 6 Degrees of Sarzo, his radio show.
Yeah.
He's like the Kevin Bacon of music.
Yep.
Everybody's connected to him, one band or another.
Yep.
And everybody loves him.
Yep. It's incredible.
And we got a chance to talk to him. And of course, because a lot of you guys know him, the huge Randy Rhoads fan, he gets into so much detail about it. And Randy, you're going to love this. Let's get to it. Here is Rudy Sarzo.
All right, this week we are in the presence of hard rock royalty, a legend in our world and your world. He has played with some of our favorite bands, Quiet Riot, Ozzy Osbourne, Whitesnake, and so much more. Let's welcome the legendary bass player, the great Rudy Sarzo. Rudy, welcome to the show, my man.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is an honor for us to have such a legend like yourself. This is great. Thank you.
So
I'm just getting started here. So
good for you. Good for you.
What's funny is, Tom, like, you know, we were just brushing up. We know your history and your background, and we were brushing up on your Wikipedia page.
Wrong.
And there's like 15 names there you got, buddy. So can you tell us what's your real official name?
That's about the only thing that's correct on Wikipedia. Everything else is like, no.
Okay.
But we're going to have fun, you know, demystifying the myth that lives in Wikipedia land. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Okay.
Perfect.
We can do that.
So we met, and I don't know if you'll remember this, but we met not too long ago. You played with Quiet Riot at Preacher's Fest
in Nashville in 2022.
Oh, yes, we did. Yeah. That was fun.
So at the end of the whole event, it was crazy. It was like the last night.
Mm-hmm.
All us podcasters and buddies are all hanging out in the bar. And poor Rudy Sarzo, not knowing a thing, walks into the bar, probably just grab a drink or something. And we all attacked you. We all jumped up, forced you to come sit down with us, and we took a big pic with you. And all us, there was like 20 podcasts there, and we all were all in heaven. And you walked right in on us. And
I remember that. Yeah, that was the only place to get food that was open at the time.
That's right. That's right.
And I've been sober for 26 years, so me walking into a bar is basically I'm looking for food. So it's the only place that has food at the time. So yeah.
That was so great because we had just finished watching you, because obviously Quiet Riot was part of Creatures Fest, and you walked in, and everyone's like, there's Rudy Sarzo, and poor Rudy. And we all just attack you because we all had to get a picture of the legend Rudy Sarzo. So that was a fun moment for us. And then I also had a moment where I didn't meet you, but I saw you very, very up close and personal probably about 10 or so years ago in Boston when you were touring with Jeff Tate's Queensryche on the Mindcrime anniversary tour. We were right up front. That was obviously fantastic. We'll talk about that and so much more. Zeus, I know, has something that he wants to start with you on here.
Yeah. So, Rudy, I'm not sure which incarnation we can start with, because to me, you've been in three bands almost at their height.
Yeah.
So you've got the Quiet Riot, Metal Health, number one album in the U.S. where hard rock and metal albums weren't doing that. And you guys hit it off big. And I remember as a young kid, teenager, we're talking 10 years old, how big Quiet Riot, Metal Health was. Then all of a sudden, this band called Whitesnake comes up. Now, I didn't know you weren't on the original 87 title track, but I remember the videos. And I remembered your moves. I'm like, oh, that's the guy from Quiet Riot. There was no, internet or anything to look you up or Google you. But I'm like, I recognize that guy, but he looks a little different. The hair color, obviously. But I remembered you from that. And then you were my first concert that year. I was my first concert. I saw you guys in Worcester with Great White opening up in Massachusetts. I think it was about 87 in Worcester, Mass. And then you're not finished. I'm not finished. I didn't realize your original impact with Ozzy and playing with Randy and playing in that band of that version of Ozzy's band. As you grow older and you start seeing more music and YouTube comes out and you start finding out all this stuff about people you're interested in. And then, you know, you're out with Dio. You've been played with Yngwie. You've played and you had a perfectly named radio show, right? 6 Degrees of Sarzo, because you are the Kevin Bacon of music. I don't know if there's anybody that doesn't know you in music or doesn't respect you or talk highly of you. You are amazing legend that only positive things are ever said about, at least as far as we're concerned. And obviously it's an honor to have you on. But I don't know which band I want to talk to you first, so I'm trying to think that through while we have you.
I know where you want to start. We want to hear about Randy Rhoads and Ozzy.
Yeah. So, just watching and prepping before to talk to you, there's a clip of videos that you guys did with Tommy Aldridge, Ozzy, you and Randy. I don't know, Mr. Crowley. And Crazy Train. I don't know if you know those like performance videos. Ozzy's got these tassels and this awful shirt that says Ozzy on it. You got like a red jumpsuit on. I don't know what that is, but watching that band perform those songs, absolutely amazing. And I'm curious because you guys all look like you're playing and having fun, and then you kind of look like you're looking over and going, holy shit, look at what Randy's doing. It is like the best live performances I've ever seen of a guitar. And I'm just amazed by it. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are being able to look back and go playing with this guy and playing with Ozzy and Tommy at that time.
Well, I need to go back to Quiet Riot, the Randy Rhoads version of the band.
Yes.
That's the first time that I experienced Randy. And it was actually a progression.
Yep.
It's not like the first day we ever played together was I aware of how deep his musical vocabulary was, because with Quiet Riot, he was very much boxed in as far as what he was able to write or allowed to write in order for us to get a record deal. That was the goal of the band, to get a record deal. So You have to be music that could be on the radio, accessible, you know? So all of Randy's wealth of musical theory and harmony and, you know, classical background playing, you know, classical guitar and composition, none of that was apparent during that period.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I became aware that Randy could actually play classical was, he asked me to teach at his mom's school, Musonia.
Mm-hmm.
And so during breaks, I would hear him pick up the acoustic guitar and start playing classical music. And I said, I don't know, you could play like that. And I said, yeah, we don't do that in Quiet Riot, blah, 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 blah. So what happened was when he went to play with Ozzy, he asked Ozzy, what do you want me to play? What do you want me to write? And Ozzy just said, be yourself. And that's when the Randy Rhoads that we know and is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame did. You know, he just started, you know, to go into places musically that he was never able to go with Quiet Riot.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was aware by the time that I started playing with him in Ozzy that he was capable of doing that. Now, one thing is to be capable at that moment, at that level, but he would progress exponentially while we were on tour.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, he will be twice as good as he was the day before. And that was amazing to hear. But then again, that was expected. It was like, what's Randy going to play today? How's he going to top last night? And he always did. You know, never had a bad show. Tommy Aldridge, I never saw him have a bad show either. Ozzy is very emotional. It's kind of like he picks up on the environment, and if there's some stuff going on, it will come out on his playing, his singing. You know, of course, again, your instrument is your body, your voice, whereas we guitar players, drummers, bass players, we funnel that through the instrument itself, which is not necessarily attached to our body. It's attached, we play through it, but it's not part of our body. Very different with the vocals, you know. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys ever watched that. It's called, there's two Speak of the Devil. There's the mm-hmm. Ozzy re-recordings of Black Sabbath songs.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was the first Speak of the, actually, that was not the, it was the first, yes, it was the first Speak of the Devil content that was done, because we did that in June of 1982. That was mm-hmm. the last show we did in Continental USA of the Diary of a Madman tour. We did a couple of other shows. we did the Cotton Bowl, and then we did another festival in New Orleans. And then those were the last two shows that we did of that year as far as the Diary of a Madman tour did. And then you have the recordings of Speak of the Devil at the Ritz in New York. That was the last time I ever played with Ozzy. And what happened was for that show in Irvine, California, it was the Diary of a Madman tour with Brad Gillis playing guitar. See, people yeah. ask me, oh, how come there's no Randy footage? Well, what you see with Brad Gillis playing, that was planned months in advance for Randy to be doing that, but mm-hmm. he passed away.
Yep.
So there was a plan, and you always wait to hit certain cities where logistically it makes sense to have the crew there locally. So they we pick, you know, I didn't do anything. The management picked Los Angeles, because obviously all the production companies, the major ones, are in LA and New York. So LA, that makes sense. Okay. And it happened to be the last show of the Diary of a Madman tour in the Continental USA. Well, what happened was that Randy died. Okay. Well, they still, you know, they're under contract to do this show, and we continue. And Brad Gillis happens to be the one who was playing in the band at that time. But yeah, that was planned. But it, mm-hmm. Randy died too soon, you know. Mm. And going back to talking about Randy, he's you know, watching him play every single night. It was just, you know, it was a revelation, but also it's not that you get spoiled and used to it. It's just that you expect it. Mm. And for me to go on stage with musicians of that level, especially Randy, all I have to do is just worry about myself. I don't have to worry about it, Randy. He's got that covered. All I have to worry about is me keeping up with him and everybody else.
Yeah,
that's all I did, you know, and enjoy the moment and know that every show is a blessing and be grateful.
Yeah, yeah, I think, you know, obviously the tragic young early loss of Randy, you know, hit everybody. Obviously, it hit you very, very close. You know, he was a dear friend, bandmate. But for us as music fans, you know, for me, you know, and for Zeus, selfishly, we love and adore what Randy Rhoads did. And part of the tragedy is that his career was cut so short that his name should be talked about more. In our circles, he is, because that's what we listen to. But I feel like a guy like that, like you kind of hinted at it, like when you're playing with him, whether it's in the studio or on the stage or touring, at that moment, are you kind of just sitting there going, this guy is going to be the next big name in guitar? Because at that time, you had Eddie Van Halen was just coming on the scene. You already had Ritchie Blackmore. You had those legends, and Randy was poised to be that next thing. He still is in our eyes because of what he did during his short time to contribute. But when you were you just kind of like in awe of this young man? Like you said, he keeps getting better and better and better.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/Pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Was I, you know, to be honest with you, it did not take for Randy to play with Ozzy for me to realize that he was going to be destined to be the next big legendary guitar player.
Yeah.
I witnessed that, like I mentioned, watching him. I mean, you know, we did a lot of shows in Quiet Riot too, you know.
Right.
And
right.
It never mattered. See, one of the key ingredients about Randy is it didn't matter how many people were in the audience. Because I got to tell you, by 78, when I joined the band, and 79, when Randy left, the reason why he left was because nobody cared about Quiet Riot. Yeah. We had two albums that came out in Japan, which still means that you cannot get those records in the United States. You can't tour with those records because they're not on the radio. Nobody cares. Promoters will not hire you. So we were just another LA local band.
Right.
Yep. You know. And that's the reason why Randy left. If those two records that he did in Japan mattered, he would have never left.
Yeah.
Because all he wanted was right here. But no, it wasn't. It didn't, you know, that career did not exist. that later on happened with the Metal Health version of the band, because then we had an international release, you know. Mm-hmm. And that record, by the way, is dedicated to his memory. If you got a vinyl cover, you know, so
yep,
that record was pretty much done in the spirit, you know, to celebrate and just, you know, for the memory of Randy. We all did it for that, you know. And so, you know, going back to, was I aware that Randy was going to be? Yeah, but, you know, it didn't. It's funny because to me, he did not need the validation of a million fans for me to know that.
Yeah.
I knew that. I was in the room with him and I go, okay, this guy is it. Look at him. There's nobody like him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, to put everything in perspective, it took us a while to actually find somebody who could emulate Randy's guitar playing style. And Brad Gillis, you know, was able to do that. And the reason why he was discovered is because Pat Thrall, who was a guitar player in Pat Travers, who played with Tommy in that version of the band.
Yep.
His brother saw Brad Gillis play in a early version of the Alameda All Stars, which became Night Ranger.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Playing in the Bay Area. And they were doing covers. So they were doing an Aussie song, and Pat Thrall's brother heard it, him playing, and go, oh, this guy, you know, he can, you know, he's got that technique. He can do that technique that Randy uses on records, you know, and that's how he was discovered.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the questions I'll ask you is, so the thing that I always find amazing is he's got that classical music guitar training and background. And a lot of people, they talk about Ritchie Blackmore has that and this and that. But to me, what separates him and what gives Randy the uniqueness is not only can he just, you know, shred with the best of them if he needs to, but he's got this clean, melodic guitar that, and I'm driving, picking up my daughter from school, and I'm playing Blizzard of Oz back, and I'm like, listen to that guitar on this Crowley, Mr. Crowley solo. It's almost like an orchestra, like violins playing. And I don't know anybody, and I've said this on our show, we review rock albums all the time. That's the greatest guitar album for me. It's my favorite. There's nobody that can do that. I can't explain it, but you as a musician, you have, who's played with him and has played with many, many great guitar players. What is it about the sound? Because the only thing I can think of is he's more melodic than anybody, the way he can hold the note. And it's almost like orchestral. That's how I see him different. But I need somebody to explain to me what I'm hearing, because I don't know the words to say, like, why is this guy to me above everybody?
Okay. Let me jump in. Okay. Of all the guitar players that, you know, and I played, you know, I play with Steve Vai, I play with Inve, I did a tour with him.
Yep.
Adrian Vandenberg, Juan DeMartini, Brad Gillis, Tony McAlpine. I mean, there's so many great guitar players that I play with. But Randy was the only guy who at least will double track all his solos.
Ah, okay.
Perfectly. Mm-hmm. Double tracking. And that just adds all these different harmonics and frequency. So you might be, there's two things. There's the choice of notes.
Yeah.
And then there is the tone of the instrument. And he was very unique in that. The fact that he used a very early version of a pedal board that later on, you know, other companies started to like put together. It was like you could pick the routing. So not everything's going through the whole pedal board at the same time. You switch the routing of the pedals, so you maintain the integrity of the tone without being going through all of these pedals always at the same time.
Okay.
You know, there were other switching systems later on that were developed, but this was Randy's. And he used the wah-wah for tone. He would step on it and find that sweet spot for certain tones sound or on certain solos. Rarely do you hear him do a wah-wah solo. No, he's using the wah-wah to kind of like shelf the frequency, especially the mid-range. You know, he had two echo plexus, one feeding into the other. And most important, that sound was in his hands. He played gauge 11 GHS boomer strings.
Yep.
And everything adds up. So he was so important in the development of palm muting, rapid fire rhythm riffs, right?
Yep.
He was like, that's why we had such a hard time trying to find somebody who could actually do that. You know, he showed me. He says, listen, you know, be passionate, you know, be angry, like, you know, like metal.
Yeah.
From your wrist up. Everything from your wrist down is gentle. He plays so loud. Like, you know, we used to have like, you know, whatever band was on tour with us, sometimes they'll go up to Randy during sound check and say, hey, can I check out your rig? And Randy will give him the guitar. And it would be total feedback because they did not know how to control it.
Right.
You know,
right.
That had a lot to do with the muting and standing in a certain position so the guitar doesn't feedback. He had, when we did Diary of a Madman and we had the castle, there were three Marshall stacks with JBL speakers behind where the castle is, right behind the castle. Then he had one Marshall stack on the side, which again with JBLs, and one in the pit, the security pit, you know, the barrier that separates the band from the audience. And he was loud. He was loud, but it was a control loud. It was not I never heard him feedback, lose control of his tone or anything, you know. But he was very sensitive in his playing, which came from playing classical guitar. You just don't bang on it. You know, one thing that really separated Randy, well, one of many things, from anybody else I've ever played with, was the fact that he came from an academia, music academia family. Mom and dad, music professors, they built Musonia, that school that's still out there in North Hollywood.
Yep.
So Randy, that's all he knew. And we're talking about, you know, he must have been born in the 60s or late 50s. In the 60s. And I think it was 1956. Is that when he was born? 1956? And so immediately, you know, by the time he was 3-4 years old, he was playing classical guitar. Mm-hmm. At the school, they were teaching him how to do it. And then he got better than the teacher. So the teacher could not show him anymore. So then they made him a teacher.
Yeah.
By the time, But he went through academia. He learned everything from the way that it's been taught since classical days. You know, the way that Bach would teach, or any of these great composers who were also teachers.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a system that you go through. You start very at the bottom and you build yourself up. You know, you go with it, you know, and that's how Randy learned. Which means that he was a complete musician. By the time that I played with him in Quiet Riot in 1978, he used to teach 8 hours a day.
Ooh, wow.
And then go over and rehearse for a couple of hours with Quiet Riot. And this happened every single night, like, unless we were performing. And then he would teach, and then we would go and perform on the weekends with us. You know, so that was his world. Again, this is, we're talking about the 70s and 80s. Yeah. No social media,
no YouTube videos he's putting up.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes that could be a distraction. If you don't know how to manage your time, which is something that I learned, and I actually learned that from Steve Vai when we were touring, because he was like the ultimate time management musician I've ever played with. Because, you know, unlike Randy was just focused on playing and developing different techniques and getting deeper into his classical music and all of that. Whereas by the time that I toured with Vai, that was about 6 years later. Yeah, mm-hmm. six, seven yep. years later. Mm-hmm. You know, then there's different technology. Now we got the personal computer, and Bai will always bring a computer with him. And while he was, when he was touring with us for the Slip of the Tongue record. He was getting ready to release Passion and Warfare. So during his guitar solo, the band, our band, Whitesnake, we would play about 20 minutes worth of his music from the record. You know, so we got very familiar with that. And so he was able to promote his record, Passion and Warfare, while he was touring with Whitesnake. Genius. Yeah. You know, but I got to tell you, it was so... Steve would not waste a second of the day. As soon as we finished sound check, he would go into a tune-up room, you know, quiet, away from everybody else, keep working on the book, the sheet music book that he was releasing as a companion to Passion and Warfare. Mm-hmm. So he was doing that.
Amazing.
Then on days off, he would bring a crew to make videos of the songs that were going to be released from Passion and Warfare. Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's amazing.
It was insane. He utilized every single second. I used to bring a little, it was a portable VHS player with a tiny little screen. And Steve would borrow it, you know, two or three times a week, because he was receiving paper edits of the videos. So he would look at the video and look at the Senti code and say, okay, well, this Senti code on the screen at 3 minutes and 19 seconds, I want it quicker. And he will make all of that.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I'm just like bringing stuff up that is really fresh in my mind. I mean,
yeah,
the guy was the most motivated musician, time management.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, time management. You know, he's just used up every single moment of his life.
That's right. You were right. Yeah. Randy was December 6, 1956.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rudy, let me ask you this. So we've talked about Randy. You hinted a little bit at Steve Vai. You know, we'll get into some of the other guys. You know, you mentioned Adrian Vandenberg and Yngwie. They're all legendary in their own different ways and different styles. When you're performing with them, how does their style affect what you're doing, if it has an effect at all? Because obviously when you're playing with Randy, it's different from what Steve Vai is doing. Maybe to some people it might sound the same, but to us and to you, it's different as it is with Adrian Vandenberg and Yngwie, et cetera. Does that affect you and how you play, or affect how you approach what you're doing with each band member?
You know, that's really a good question, but the only way, I mean, thinking back of how I do it, it's like a conversation, you know. I mean, we're having this conversation now.
Yep.
How many of these conversations have you had before this one?
Right. Lots of different ones with different people. Right.
Like 50, let's say, yeah. Let's say 50. I bet you they were all different.
Yeah. Good point.
Different.
Yep.
You know, and it's the same thing when you play. I mean, when you play, it's you're communicating mm-hmm. with each other, and then there's an audience witnessing that, the act of the communication that's going on. But you're basically doing it for yourself. It's kind of like it all starts with you. You're doing it with you, and then you find people that like what you do and that you like what they do. You put a band together, and then you find something in common that you want to say with your music, lyrically especially. And then you find a record company signs you up. I mean, I'm talking about the traditional way, you know. Now it's, you know, nobody even knows. It's just whatever works.
Yeah, exactly.
Know? And you know, there was a system. And then the last is actually playing it for the audience.
Right.
You know, and it's... And it's really interesting because it is the audience that makes it possible for you to have a career, so you can keep doing this
mm-hmm.
for as long as they keep showing up. If they don't show up, well, you're still going to do this, but you're probably going to do this at home.
Right. Yeah, you know. Exactly. That's funny. But think of all the, I mean, we were talking about earlier when I first started with him, like starting running off all these legendary acts that you've played with. Do you have a favorite time in a specific band that you said, this is my favorite? If I could go back, like this was the funnest time I ever had and enjoyed playing music live. Was it with Whitesnake at its prime? Was it Quiet Riot on Metal Health? Was it, you know, with the Aussie band or maybe Dio or Jeff Tate? Who knows? I'm just curious. What was yours? Because you have so many legendary acts.
Well, for a singular band leader, you know, and I mean, you know, Ozzy or Ronnie, it's not Ronnie, yeah. James Dio.
Yeah.
I would have to say Ronnie. Mm. I mean, okay, let's put it this way. If it wasn't for Ozzy, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. You know, okay. Ozzy, yep. Sharon, you know, they took me in based on Randy's recommendation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they changed my life, you know, and I owe them that. But nevertheless, there was usually some drama going on.
You think?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Especially
in those days with Ozzy and Sharon. Yeah, we've all read the stories and stuff. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's I'm grateful that I was there. And of course, I understand the source of the drama and all of that. And, you know, but going into, if you're talking about a band where I'm gonna show up and play with Ronnie James Dio,
mm-hmm.
and it's very simple. He goes, this is what happened. Ronnie expected the most out of himself.
Mm.
You know, it was about Ronnie going up there and giving it all, not only for the band but for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The fans, the family. It was really, you know, a lot of them were just, you know, family members of the Dio, you know, family. Yeah. And there was no drama. Only time there was maybe some drama was because if he felt that he did not give everything that he could have, that somehow, some way, there might have been some technical difficulty that got in the way or whatever happened.
Yeah.
It was like he left the stage and he felt that he just, there was not that show that he was hoping for. And to be honest with you, I never heard Ronnie have a bad night, but he had a certain level that he wanted to perform at, you know. And so I would say Ronnie, because to witness that in musical integrity, there's been very few musicians that I play with that had. And I'm talking about musical integrity. And I want to say the first one was Randy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know, that's nothing. It was all about the music.
Yep.
Yeah.
Nothing else mattered. You know, we Randy and I, we never talked about politics. We never talked about religion. Never talked about who was going out with who. It was all about, we got to write a song that we're going to get signed with. That's all we care about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Musical content, you know, how to take Quiet Riot to the next level. And to me, that's what lives in what we do today with Quiet Riot. That's how I go on stage. You know, I go on stage as 1978. We still have to prove ourselves every single night, just like we did back then, Quiet Riot. You know, this is not about, okay, we sold, you know, so many records and blah, blah, blah. Let's just kind of like, you know, lay back and just play the song. No. I'm going on stage and I'm on a time machine back to 1978. You know, I'm in my 20s again.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to give 1,000% just like I did then. And I'm auditioning at the same time for that crowd that might have never seen the band. I never seen me in 1978 or in 82, 80, 83, 84, 85, you know, or even in the 90s when we all got back together again.
Yep.
And that's it. You know what? I got something to prove, and I'm going to have something to prove until my last breath.
You know, that is such an incredible statement that you just made, which I think lends itself to why you are the legend that you are, because you don't take advantage of your fans. You don't take advantage of the people that are seeing you in concert or buying your records, or like you said, it's 1978. You're proving yourself again. You want to go out and be the best for people who have never seen you or for people who have been watching you for the last 40 years. And, you know, we're not going to name names or drag anybody through the mud, but there are plenty of people out there who rest on their laurels, who are like, yeah, I'm this person, I'm that band, et cetera, et cetera. We know you're going to come and see us, so we're going to do this. But to hear an artist such as yourself say, no, this is the first show I've ever played, and I'm going to show the audience that. And I want them to go home or experience this as if it's the first time. Because you're, like you said, it might be. You've been around for a long time, but there are people that are still catching up to where you are in the music world. And I applaud you for that type of mentality, because I think it's refreshing, especially these days.
It's a combination of many things. And by the way, thank you so much. But it's pretty much like, you know, I know what it was like to be on stage for the last time with Randy, mm-hmm. not knowing it was going to be your last time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, you got to play like there's no tomorrow.
Yep.
Right now, this moment, this song, this note you're going to play, it's all you got,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then you add up on top of that, you know, what I learned about from Randy about having integrity in everything that you do. You know that, and this has been documented many times, that Randy had given notice to leave Ozzy to go back to school to get his degree in music, you know.
That's right. Yep.
At a time where he was already, he knew that people were listening to him, but he was not built to play the same songs every night over and over. There was so much creativity in him. He just hated that.
Yeah.
And by the time he passed away, well, he left LA in 1979. Immediately he started working with Ozzy, putting a band together because people did not want it to join.
Yeah,
you know, Bob Daisley joined the band. He was part of the Jet Records family. He was in a band previously called Widowmaker. Mm-hmm. That was part of Jet Records. They had the hardest time finding a drummer. You know, and finally Lee Kerslake joins the band. So all they did was waiting for the right combination of people. They didn't even have a producer. What Randy told me was that Max Norman was the house engineer at the recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
And people were promising him coming by, you know, to produce the record. And one day, Ozzy got fed up and said, screw this. He asked Max, you know how to turn this thing on, you know, the board. Okay, you're the producer. Yeah, he just want to get it done.
Yep.
You know? This guy is sitting on all this incredible music and performances, but there's nobody to produce it. You know, so that's how Max became the producer on those records. You know, so there's so much backstory to the reason why I am who I am, mainly because of the influence, the impact that my bandmates have had on me. For better, mostly for better, and then for worse. But I won't carry that with me. That's like you just leave that behind. You learn from it and you move on, you know. But I got to tell you, as far as having fun, a great time going on stage, you know, with a purpose, leaving my house with a purpose.
Yep.
My purpose is to go on stage and celebrate the legacy of the band, Quiet Riot, and the memory of Frankie Benali, Kevin Dubrow, and Randy Rhoads. I never had that before. Mm. All I had was, well, we're going to play some songs and we're going to go on tour and, you know, kick ass on stage, whatever. It was like, kind of like, okay, but something was missing.
Mm.
Something was really missing, you know, and now I have that in my life.
That's great.
The purpose.
That's great.
That's
awesome.
Now, one of the other things that you did was become part of Whitesnake, where the band had already released the album. You guys come in, and it's like he hits your perfect this guy. And, of course, he picks you for the bass. Now you got a bunch of big personalities. The album takes off. What was it like there? Because you I think you were there for two albums with David Coverdale, and that toured with Whitesnake the album, but you didn't play on it. But then you were on Slip of the Tongue. But those two albums and tours, you were with a lot of big personalities, a lot of talent, and the band was huge. What was that like in handling? Because in the rock, hard rock pantheon, David Coverdale is a big shadow, big personality too, along with Ronnie and along with Ozzy. And now you got three and Kevin Dubrow. That's four big kind of frontman personalities that you dealt with.
Oh yeah. I don't even call dealing with, because I was a part of that.
Yeah.
So there was no real dealing with it, kind of like,
Maybe I used the wrong terminology, but I think you understand what I'm asking. Like, what was it like with those four personalities?
Yeah, very simple. In the case of Whitesnake, Whitesnake was the support band for Quiet Riot in 1984, 40 years ago. We had our Condition Critical tour at the end of the year because we got pulled off the road in early 83 and rushed in the studio to make a record. So it came out in the third quarter of 84 and then a subsequent tour. And Whitesnake was with the support band. And so David got to see me and I got to see them performing every single day. So on the last day of our tour together, we're saying our goodbyes in the tour bus, and he gives me a hug and whispers in my ear, "We're going to be playing together soon." And I'm thinking, how does he know that I've given notice to the band that I'm leaving after the end of the tour? I had no idea. So, that stays there. And then I continued playing with Quiet Riot. Then the tour ends and I leave the band and we start Tommy Aldridge and I start putting a band together. And then we get a call. This is 1985. We get a call from Whitesnake management that they want to talk to us. So we go to the office and they offer us the rhythm section. This is 1985. And Tommy Aldridge and me. And then I find out that one of the key elements as far as the friction that I was aware within the band was still in the band. Everybody else was gone except for this person. Very talented. But as far as having conflict with David, it was very clear.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm just leaving one situation. I don't want to jump into another situation. So I'm going to pass. And Tommy did the same thing later on. And then a couple of years later, we get another call. Now, this time is to actually perform on the video. Still of the Night. This call now by then the record is done and they're getting ready to make the video. And by this time that conflicting band member was not in there anymore. And it's a member of Whitesnake. So it was like safe. Now it's safe to walk in there. And actually, my wife and I, we've been watching videos of lately of that, of that era, because I always took video with me, or either I was on stage and my wife was taking videos, and it was so, so wonderful. Everybody got along wonderful. It was very peaceful. It was great. It really was. I have wonderful memories of that.
Oh, that's great. I remember there's a story. Now, you guys played with Kiss at one point, correct? Mm-hmm. And there was a conflict there between David and Paul got into an argument of some sort. I don't know if you know the exact story, but
Rudy's chuckling, so he might.
Is that a story that you can share with us? What was that really about and what happened?
I was there, so.
Okay, perfect. What can you share with us?
It was very simple, and it was very funny, actually. Well, okay. I have met Paul back in 78 when I joined Quiet Riot.
Okay.
And I met him And every
I can't wait now.
We talk about this all the time. As a matter of fact, he'll tell, like, let's say he introduces me to somebody, and then he'll go and tell the story himself. You know. Okay. So, it was actually really, really, really nice. I just started working at this health food place on Sunset Boulevard on the strip right across from Tower Records. And a lot of celebrities used to go there because it was like the hip thing to do in LA in the 70s. Eat vegan, vegetarian, right? Yeah. Okay. And by the way, I can make a mean veggie burger. And I'm talking about old school veggie burger from back in the 70s. Okay.
Not the impossible things that they do now.
I do enjoy the impossible one. I guess I'm one of the very few. Maybe not. Maybe there's more people like me, but I do really enjoy it.
Okay. You know,
that's my to-go thing when I go to Starbucks, get the impossible burger that they have. But anyways, so I'm learning the cashier registers early in the morning. And I hear the door open to this place that I was working at, McNaturals. It was kind of like a fast food. It was a fast food place.
Mm-hmm.
Fast food, health food. That was the concept. And I hear the door open and shut, and I look up. And this is before they were unmasked.
Yeah.
This is when yes. they were still wearing makeup. And they had just come out with a record of the four of them. I mean, four solo records, four of them, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I look up and I go, oh, my God, it's Paul Stanley. Even without the makeup.
You recognize.
You could tell. You could recognize him.
Yeah. 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 So I was like all flustered, you know, I'm like, I don't have the machine down, you know, the cash register down yet. But so I'm kind of like. And I have my hair was really long. It was like down to my waist, but it was tied in a knot in the back, and I would put it inside my shirt. So I kind of looked like I had the weirdest haircut, you know, kind of like a Donny Osmond with a page boy, you know. Yeah, just like that. But it was part of the gig. And so, you know, with time, he kept coming back and. And, you know, we started talking. I mean, he knew I was a musician. I gave him one of the Quiet Riot 2 copies, you know, just to show it to management, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, he was really a super cool guy. I'll always remember what he ordered. He ordered a sprout salad with one scoop of tuna fish on top called the Wonder of the Orient and one... one small glass of, I mean, cup, they were paper cups, of carrot juice.
Oh, God.
Carrot juice.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Wow.
He was consistent. Every single time he came in, that's what he ordered. Yeah.
Wow. Now, what about the story?
So what I'm trying to say is that I knew Paul, and then once I joined Ozzy, it was like, oh man, you know, congratulations, and you know, we got even closer because now, you know, I'm playing with Ozzy, so you know, and so that kind of like that's what our relationship remained, you know, once I joined Ozzy, and then so here we are, playing. It's in Toronto. And it's a baseball stadium, not a major league, but a
minor league baseball
stadium. Yeah, and I had done some shows there before with other bands, with Quiet Riot, you know, playing with other bands. And so what happened was there were going to be two shows, and the promoter thought, you know what, I think I can get more people in the venue if I can actually put both bands together on the same bill in a stadium.
Yeah,
and. So somehow, some way, Kiss, this is before they had the makeup back on.
Yeah.
Wound up playing right before us, which meant that they were going on around. This is the summertime.
Yeah.
In Toronto, where the sun doesn't set until like maybe 9:30.
Yep.
And they were going on like maybe 6 o'clock because we were going, you know, they did the full show set list wise. And then we came on like around 8 o'clock. And so even if they wanted to use all the pyros, it was going to be daylight.
Yeah.
Completely.
Right.
You know, at that time. But somebody in management made sure that they knew that they were not allowed to use pyro anyways.
Oh, boy.
So this is...
Wait. Whose management told them they weren't allowed?
Well, Whitesnake.
Oh, Whitesnake's
manager. Oh, Whitesnake's. Okay.
Said to Paul and Kiss, you're not doing it.
Well, you're not. Yeah, you're not. You're doing the show without pyro.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Boy.
Okay.
And, this is going to go over well.
Actually, I did not know anything about this until the shit hit the fan, you know, about it. And so, you know, we get to the venue and I just walk on stage and I'm on the side of the stage watching the band. And Paul turns to me and waves and smiles and I do the same thing. And then the song ends and he starts going into a speech about how David Coverdale was not allowing Kiss to give their fans a real Kiss show because they were not allowed to use the pyro. And, the whole place just turned on us. And I'm listening to this. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, like, wow. I mean, it was like, okay, this is weird, but it doesn't really change anything for me. All I know is that, all I know is that, you know, usually what happens is the first row of that show was hardcore Kiss fans.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and so when we came on, they let us know we were number one.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
During the whole show. That just
went, Jesus.
And I thought, wow, that's stamina. These Kiss fans.
Good for them. Now, did Paul and David have words at the time, like with each other?
It was just like a lot of backstage huffing and puffing, but there was no confrontations. You know, it was a stadium. So we were like one side of the dressing rooms and the lockers, and then the other side of the lockers. We're kept separated anyway. But
so many years later, Kiss fans like us know the story.
Oh, yeah.
It's permeated like throughout time that, do you ever hear the time that David Coverdale and Paul Stanley got into? I'm like, no, not two of my favorite bands. I don't want to hear this. And I knew that there was something there. I just wanted to get it from you while I have it.
Yeah. But just like any myth, you know, it always gets blown out of proportion.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sure. You know, actually, my last show with Ronnie was with Kiss in Bilbao.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that was, we did a festival, beautiful festival. It was televised, so I'm pretty sure there's some
video. What year was this?
I think it was 2008.
Okay.
So before Sonic Boom, I'm thinking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
I mean,
that's makeup.
That's makeup album. Kiss.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're wearing the makeup. It's really funny because, you know, we were all hanging backstage for a few hours before we went on. You know, this is a big festival, and there were a lot of our friends that we wanted to hang out with that were also playing there. And so when they're early and Gene is like, you know, dressed casual, you know, off stage Gene, and then they go into the dressing room and come back.
Yeah.
As, you know, with the makeup. And now Gene is in the demon mode.
Yeah, personality. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's not talking to anybody. He's just sitting in a corner, kind of like looking mean at everybody. Like, you know.
That's great. Okay.
Rudy, let me ask you. So I just lost my train of thought.
You wanted to ask him about Yngwie?
Yes, thank you. Yes.
I knew you got to get a question in about.
I got to get a question because I'm an Yngwie fan. Like, I don't like everything that he's ever done, but I'm a huge fan of his. So we talked about personalities that you performed with, whether it's lead singers, et cetera, et cetera. How did you hook up with Yngwie? And just kind of tell us briefly, or not, about your experience working with him, because as fans of Yngwie, we know that he can kind of have a large personality sometimes.
I love large personalities. I live for that because I feel like I have the best seat in the house to experience.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
You know, like, you know, whether it's on stage or backstage, you know. Yeah. Invite was great. I love playing with him.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah. It's Invite Molson, you know, and this is a time where the band were still part of the show, not just like on the side of the stage.
Yeah, where they get fired. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Sticks everybody over the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is 2004, because I played with him. And then while I was playing with Inve, I got a call from from Wendy Dio, Ronnie's manager.
Yeah.
Yep. To come and play on the Master of the Moon record, but I was on tour with Inve. Mm-hmm. So I joined Dio after I finished that tour. So there was the Attack US tour of 2004. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was great. I mean, I used to, you know, it was a family affair. He had his son, Antonio, with him. April, we're all on the same tour bus hanging, and the band, great guys and really nice, challenging music. I got to play, you know, 10 years worth of notes in about 4 months. Yeah. It was great. I needed that. I really needed that.
Yeah. Oh, that was going to be my next question. So when you're playing a lot of melodic hard rock with Quiet Riot and Whitesnake and even the Aussie stuff with Randy, then you go to Inve, and like you just said, he's just burning up the fretboard. And Rudy, how are you, like, okay, is this the only gear that this guy is in right now? Like you said, 10 years worth of notes in, you know, 4 months or whatever.
Yeah, but it, you know, it's the same music theory.
Yeah.
It's the same notes. We only got 12 notes.
Yeah,
but they're
true.
Just being played, you know, 10 times as fast as the regular song.
Yeah.
But it's still the same thing. You just play it faster, you know, and you understand the modes that he's using. You understand, you know, when he's using a harmonic minor or, you know, and basically you just listen. No, okay. So, you know, it was a style of music that I had not really played. The closest thing would have been Randy with Ozzy, you know, certain songs from Diary of a Madman or even Revelation Mother Earth that were in.
Oh, don't get me started. I love that. You know, I love that. You
know, yeah. In that classical vein.
Yes, totally. Yep.
You know, these are conversations that I used to have with Randy back, because Randy was such a great teacher. So it was natural for him to share information about his writing style. I mean, if you look at are you guys musicians?
I can noodle a little bit with guitars. I'm not going to pretend that I'm some kind of pro.
Nothing.
Yeah, I can. Nothing. I can play some piano and some guitar.
Well, you can play the radio. That's the most important.
Yes, we can do that.
Or a million CDs and music.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, again, you know, I'm sitting there with Randy. Of course, we're going to have a musical conversation and use certain language and vocabulary. You know, he would explain to me that basically the first record was diatonic. Like if you listen to Crazy Train, listen to Mr. Crowley, Goodbye to Romance, all those songs have a tonic, a tone center that uses all the modes from that certain tone center, whether it would be, let's say, Crazy Train, it's really A major. If you listen to the verse, it's a very happy sounding guitar riff. And then you go to the relative minor, the F sharp minor. And that's where the
Yes.
We talked but about it's all relative. That. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all relative. You know, it's kind of like, it's like songwriting 101. Mm-hmm. You know, where, you know, a certain section of the song is minor, relative minor to the major of the tone center. But by the time that he started writing for Diary of a Madman, which was a short period, you know, they finished Diary and then they start working on, I mean, they finished Blizzard. Then they started working on Diary like within weeks of that. Yep. His writing really changed.
Yeah,
there was a lot of, it was playing, you know, model substitution all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. That's how, you know, like if you listen to the song Diary of a Madman,
that's a good example. So good.
Yeah, yeah. Of how his musical direction as a composer really, really took a giant leap.
Totally.
And that's what I hear from people that are musicians and stuff. So for me, for my ear, non-musician, I listen to Blizzard of Oz and I say, that's the greatest guitar album of all time. I love it. It moves me when I hear him play his solos and all that. But then others will be like, oh no, Diary of a Madman, you're so mistaken, is so much more complex. He might make it seem easy, but it's so much more advanced in such a small period of time from where he was Blizzard that it's that's the more like a guitarist looking at it, like, oh shit, I gotta do that. Like that's more difficult what he was doing in Diary than Blizzard, which is more to me, more easy for the ears.
But what I find interesting about that is that it's not like Randy all of a sudden went to Musicians Institute or Berkeley and got that knowledge in about 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
No, he knew that already, but he knew how to create a foundation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Create a foundation. A lot of the riffs, the seed of the riffs that he was playing that he brought to Ozzy for the Blizzard of Oz, we were doing those in demos for Quiet Riot. It's very simple. Yep. It's very simple. Okay, yep. Any musician, let's say a musician leaves a band and gets together with some new bunch of guys or girls, right? And they go, what do you got? Well, you got what you just brought from your other band.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly.
That's the first thing you got.
That's right.
You know, I say, well, I got the stuff that I was doing before and we can rework it and do whatever we want, but because I wrote it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, right? So a lot of what's on Blizzard of Oz is like, if you look at Goodbye to Romance, there's a song called that became known as Winners Take All.
Okay.
Quiet Riot's second record. The original version of that was called Teenage Anthem. And we used to play it never even made it to a demo. What it made it to was that we used to play it live, and there's some bootleg live.
I'm going to go on YouTube afterwards now. Yeah.
Teenage Anthem. Then it got reworked musically and lyrically for the Condition Critical record, and it became Winners Take All. But if you listen to the guitar, the chord sequences, it's basically a reworking of that song, which Randy wrote.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, Rudy. It's funny. I was going to say, just before we wrap up here, earlier in the conversation, you were saying how Randy would get better by the day or by the night, that like what he did today, tomorrow would be better. And it's almost like we were just talking about the difference between Blizzard and Diary. I hear that a lot. I personally love them both. I lean towards Blizzard like Zeus, but a lot of people like, no. Diary is his magnum opus because of it. Yeah. It almost kind of reminds me of what you said, is that he got that much better. And it wasn't like it was a 3 week period. It's just the progression. By the time it came time to write Diary, he just kind of blew up in terms of the what he did musically.
To encapsulate what you just said, I've had Scandinavian musicians in black metal, death metal, come up to me and say, the Diary of a Madman record is what started that movement.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Yep.
That title track, I can tell, had a lot to do with it.
Yep.
It's amazing. It's amazing stuff. And Rudy, listen, I know we've taken up a lot of your time, but I've got to put this out here. For us fans of Randy Rhoads' music, and never mind just your incredible own career, And I, when I talked to you, I pulled you aside in Creatures Fest and I said this to you. To me, like, Randy lives through you and your stories. There's nobody that can tell them or knows him better than you. And his legacy lives. And I've never seen you ever tell a Randy story without like a smile or happiness. And it's, I mean, we thank you because there's not a time after a couple of weeks or something, I'll look something up and I'll find you talking about him and I'll hear a story I never heard before. And we get to know him through what you do. Yeah. And it's a gift that you give us fans for Randy Rhoads, never mind your incredible own career. So from that, I said it to you in person. I'm saying to you again, thank you, because it means a lot to us. And hearing these stories, I will treasure this forever. And and I'm going to start looking for little other things that you were saying about him. I mean, God bless you. God bless Randy. This has been complete an honor, man, an honor.
Thank you, Sue. I don't know if you guys are aware, but I wrote a book.
Yeah.
Called Off the Rails.
Yep.
And I mean, everything that I can say about Randy, it's all in the book.
Yeah. And we'll certainly tell everybody to go pick it up, because if you want any news about Randy Rhoads, you hear it firsthand right from Rudy. And it's amazing. And God bless you for keeping his memory alive and sharing your stories of your time with him. And Randy Rhoads, man, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank Rudy, Rudy, tell our listeners and tell us, tell everybody, where can people find you and what are you doing right now as we speak? If people are interested to track down Rudy, where can they go? What are you up to?
On Mondays, I go to the oat milk section of Costco in the Woodland Hills, and I hang around for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. Nice.
I used to go to the almond milk, but then again, it takes too much water for the almond, so I now go to
I'll take your word for it. I believe you.
Yeah. No, I'm easy to find. Instagram, Facebook, and there's a few fake accounts, and it's okay. I see that as a compliment. Yeah. But it's very easy to tell me from the fake account who just opened up 2 weeks ago and has like 5 followers. I'm the guy with a gazillion followers.
Okay.
Don't go to the guy with the 5 followers. Don't even pay attention. It will go away eventually.
Yeah.
He'll get tired of this.
You know? Are you touring anytime soon, coming up and touring anything?
We're always on the road. I'll be about 2 hours away from LA this Saturday.
Okay.
And then we take another week off, and then it gets crazy. We go to Canada, 3 shows in Canada, Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver. Then I, a couple of days later, I have I'm a member of a charity event called BANC, BANC, Benevolent Artist National Charity, based in Calgary, in Canada.
Wow.
And we've been doing some charity events in Phoenix, Scottsdale, actually partnering with the Alice Cooper.
Arizona. Oh, nice. Alice Cooper land.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we did the Christmas pudding for Alice December. Okay. It was fantastic. So I'm doing that event, and then right after that I fly through Fort Lauderdale, Miami, to get on a boat called the Monsters of Rock.
You're on the Monsters of Rock.
We have a lot of friends that are going to be on that boat, so unfortunately Wyatt Riot's going to be there.
Then we get off the boat and we go on a plane and head out to the UK and do a couple of shows out there.
Nice.
Hellfest and the O2 in London, and then I come home and do my laundry, kiss my wife and my little dog, and keep on going.
And get that oatmeal. Well, he's Rudy Sarzo, the legend. Thank you again, Rudy. We really appreciate this, buddy.
Such an honor, Rudy. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. God bless. Thank you.
God bless you.
Tom, what a way to celebrate 50 episodes of Dorm Damage.
Incredible stuff. Oh, my God. I mean, we say this all the time, but this, we really meant it. We could have kept going with him. It was just incredible. The level of detail, his ability to tell a story that grabs you and just wants you listening more. Everything that he was talking about, Randy, I mean, he was breaking down scales that he was playing at one point and just incredible stuff. And then, of course, we get into Whitesnake and a little bit of the Quiet Riot, a little bit of Yngwie, a funny Kiss story near the end. Just incredible stuff above and beyond what we could have ever hoped for to have time with Rudy. Amazing.
Yeah, we hope that you guys enjoyed this. What a way to celebrate 50. Till next time, peace out, Girl Scout.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.